Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In the ongoing war of words between religious adherents and atheists, my guest says there's one shared belief between them, that atheism is a rather new phenomenon in human history, with religious adherents pointing to religious belief as an ongoing and essential part of human development, a human norm, if you will, and atheists pointing to man's evolving modernity and complexity, and it's reached a point now where man will eschew supernatural belief. But classicist Tim Whitmarsh says that man has doubted the existence of God, or more appropriately in the classical age, gods, for upwards of 2,500 years, displaying skepticism or outright rejection of religious belief for over 1,000 years before the birth of modern science. His book, Looking at the Atheistic Beginnings in the Polytheist Cultures of Greece and Rome, is titled Battling the Gods, Atheism in the Modern World. It's published by Alfred Knopf. He joins us today by phone. He's currently the Leventis Professor of Greek Culture at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He's published widely on ancient prose fiction and is the editor of the Cambridge Companion to the Greek and Roman Novel. He's currently a visiting professor at the University of Chicago. Tim Whitmarsh, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm really fascinated. What interests you in the idea of atheism going back to pre-Christian times, to the ancient world? What interests you in this question? I think when we think about the ancient world, and really up until the birth of modernism, we think of religion as being a almost universal norm.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that was really what I was trying to address in the book, was the challenge of trying to think about things in a different way and trying to disrupt our conventional view of where we came from. It has, we do, even now, even in our sophisticated postmodern world, I think we do tend to think of time as a rather linear thing, something that starts out from the primitive world and gradually feels its way, gropes its way towards modernity. But what I was trying to show in the book was actually that, firstly, there are moments when antiquity in all its variety, not just Greek and Roman, but in all its varieties, can feel incredibly close to us. And secondly, atheism in particular, I mean, it's sort of intuitively obvious, I would have thought, that to anyone, that there have been people across all times and places who can disbelieve in the efficacy of divine apparatuses. I mean, atheism isn't simply something that we've invented in the last 200 years, even though we, in the modern West, we tell ourselves that not only is it a modern thing, but it's also a Western thing. It takes sort of hyper-technical industrial modernity to create atheism, and I think that's a complete fiction.
First of all, when you go back to the ancient world, the writings are less, and religious writings seem to be the ones that are most preserved. How do you go about finding out about non-belief? Well, in early monotheism cultures like Judaism or early Christianity or early Islam, or in polytheism. Now, polytheism is really where you start.
That's right, yeah. And it's really where, in the book at least, I end up as well, because I mean, one of the things that really struck me when researching this book was just how distinctive the evidence base is for the Greek world. It's one of these things that it would be intuitively obvious to anyone if you start thinking about it, but it's not the kind of thing that we think about. The stuff that we get from antiquity generally is preserved for a reason. And with Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and so forth, it's preserved for very particular reasons. That's to say, it's because it's sacred literature, or it's in the broad penumbra of the sacred scripture. Whereas from classical antiquity, the stuff, Greek and Roman cultures, the stuff has been preserved for a wide variety of reasons. Like, for example, people wanted to write Greek like classical Greeks they've wanted to do that continuously since antiquity. So things are preserved as examples of style or as examples of interesting constructions or interesting vocabulary and that sort of thing. So that just means that with the Greek and Roman antiquity, we have a hugely more diverse array of material to look at. And this means that we've got also a more diverse set of viewpoints there. I mean, I'm sure that in all cultures, all times, there have been people that have challenged dominant norms, but the question is whether they are recorded and preserved, and those voices are audible to us now. And as I say, with Greek and Roman antiquity, those voices are audible. I gather Chinese antiquity as well. There's a rich history there.
Now, that's one area you really didn't get into.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it's beyond my competence, beyond my pay grade. But I've spoken to experts in early Chinese material, and they're it's interesting. Scholars are, you asked me whether religion was a sort of a universally saturating phenomenon in pre-modern times. And that's such a widespread belief. You know, the idea that all cultures until relatively recently thought in predominantly religious categories. And scholars of early Chinese material that I've spoken to have really fallen into two camps. I mean, some of them have said, you can't possibly imagine anything that wasn't religious in a sense. I mean, there are different varieties of religiosity, of course. And then there are people who are willing to play my game, you know, which is to say, well, actually, no, you know, these people who are strongly oppositional perspectives on conventional morality and religious morality.
Can we explore that a little more? I mean, I think when most people believe that as soon as community of humans began living together, very quickly one person became the leader and another person became the priest, you know, the religious icon, the shaman, whatever you want to call it. But it was an equally, sometimes lesser, but sometimes equally, sometimes even greater power than the temporal leader.
Okay, what interests me really about what you just said is that what you said implies a kind of distance from that process. It implies that we now, in the present, look back on that as something that is that we don't participate in quite the same way. The reason I mention that is because you have Greek writers who say exactly that. There's one of the most famous fragments of Greek atheism is it's actually excerpted from a play, and in that the speaker says, first of all, there was a lawgiver who came along because people were living in a state of violence towards each other and they were thieving and killing and so forth. And the lawgiver came around and imposed laws in order to prevent people from doing this. But the problem was then that people went around doing things in secret. So that was when religion came in, and another religious leader came in and said that there's such a thing as a God who bores into your deepest thoughts and so forth. And that person will see if you do things in private. So it's exactly that same sense of distance from religion as a social phenomenon, and that sort of ability to detach and look at it from the outside. In a way, I think this must be right, that religion emerges out of an engagement with the world and an engagement with the inexplicability and the ineffability of the world. But I think also, as long as there's been religion, there's been reflection on religion and that kind of perspective where people say, well, actually, you know, that I can see it's a social process. It's not a natural area of human experience.
You're talking about doubt, really.
Yeah.
And doubt has always been an important part of, even within faith traditions, it's sometimes not tolerated at all, but it's been an important part for the evolution of religious practices.
The one thing, the one kind of slight resistance I have to that is that the word doubt makes it sound as if it sounds very Christian, doesn't it? It sounds as if, you know, you basically believe but you have moments of doubt, whereas what I'm arguing for is something much stronger than that, which is that at all times in human societies, it's not just a question of a sort of minor wobble in your faith. It's actually, there are people who say, you know, this is not my world.
Rejection.
Don't understand it.
Rejection.
Rejection, no, that's right.
I want to go back to that opening question again of what interested you in there. Was there a particular set of writings or something that said, this is fertile ground for thought, and it's a very thought-provoking book in many ways. One, you're telling us a lot about how Greeks lived and how Greeks used their myths and, you know, the old gods, the Greek gods, and how they use those stories and how we use our own stories from monotheism today in the various religions. But was there something that sparked this interest to do this particular book? Was there something you read or was it a reflection of what's happening in the world today?
Yeah, so there are two ways of answering that question. One is, as an academic, I am paid to rummage around and to try and think about things in a different way. And as I say, with this book, what I'm really doing is trying to confront historical orthodoxies, trying to pose the question of why we've told history in this particular way and whether we can unthink this and find new ways of organizing our own experience in the present as historical entities, as people that connect with the past. But the other is, of course, a more personal thing, and you can't write about atheism or indeed religion in any period without, in a sense, having an investment. And for me, I do identify as an atheist, but I'm also rather dissatisfied with a lot of the rhetoric that comes out of the atheistic camps, which is very progressivist. It's all about, you know, the idea that you know, we've superseded religion now, and we've got to a state where religion is part of the sort of the primeval swamp that we can leave behind, and we're now in our glistening rationality, standing, looking down on the religious from a great height. And I found that very frustrating as well, because it's this myth that atheism emerged in the last 200 years has become a kind of cozy consensus between both the opponents and the proponents of new atheism. The opponents have wanted to see atheism as a brief blip, you know, a sort of pathology of secular modernity. It's something that, you know, permissive culture has brought in, but actually, you know, the basic stable position is that everyone is religious. And the proponents of atheism have been wanting to see it, as I say, as a product of modernity. And I simply don't think the world operates like that. I think that's a naive and very Western-centered, very modern-centered view of the world. So really, yes, it was both an academic and a personal attempt to shake things up and reorientate the terms of this discussion.
You did mention that quote from the play, which goes back to that old idea that, you know, once men began organizing, you have a lawgiver and then you have a oracle or religious leader to dominate behavior. But give us some of the seminal writings that exist from the Greek that sort of see that this rejection of religion, and again, we have to think of it from a polytheistic viewpoint, too, mm-hmm. from that period of time. There you had many gods, and so you could be taking guidance from one or more or none. And really, that was fairly tolerated in most of those societies, right?
Exactly, yes. Yeah, I mean, so to write a history of atheism, you don't write a history of a single phenomenon. What you have to do is start unpicking the idea of what atheism generally is. And in our modern world, atheism is seen as a very sort of simplistic category. It's one or the other. It's an on-off switch. You either believe or you disbelieve or whatever. But as you quite rightly say, in a polytheistic world, not only do you have many gods, but you also have no scripture, so there's no theological conception even of what a god is. So there's no idea of heresy or unorthodoxy. And also you have a very limited role for priesthoods as well. Priests are not guardians of public morality. They're not telling you how to believe. They're essentially organizing sacrifice and organizing the financing of temples and so forth. So the levers that religion has are much fewer and much less powerful, and there's much more space for exploring alternative ideas of the gods. Now, what I think is one of the key differences between Greek ideas of atheism and modern ideas of atheism is that Greek ideas of atheism come out of a particular mythical strand, which is to do with the idea that humans are essentially godlike beings. Humans used to live with gods. They used to, their sort of, you know, Garden of Eden moment, as it were, was a time when they used to dine with the gods and they used to be together with the gods. And then, you know, the equivalent of the fall, as it were, is a separation from the world of the gods, and humans now live a life of toil separated from the world of the gods. But what that means is that humans are always aspiring to get back to that parity with the gods. So there's always a sense of warfare, a closet warfare with the divine order. Humans are always trying to, at least in Greek myth, they're always trying to get to fly up to heaven as Bellerophon does on Pegasus and to enter the halls of Olympus, or try to overturn the divine order or something. That's why I call the book Battling the Gods, because that idea of a warfare between the human and divine is actually one of the driving forces. And I mean, it's a mythical idea. It's a narrative trope. And when you go into the philosophical world, it sort of gets left behind. But even at the beginning, I mean, one of the great atheist, in inverted commas, texts of classical antiquity is Lucretius's On the Nature of Things, which Stephen Greenblatt recently wrote a book called The Swerve, which argued that this is the invention of the European Renaissance and secular modernity was the rediscovery of Lucretius's book. But right at the beginning of that, Lucretius images his hero, who's the Greek philosopher Epicurus, as precisely this figure who elevates himself from the human plane and goes on a great sort of celestial journey, and he frees humanity from the oppression of the gods. So, yeah, there's a mythical idea of the war between humans and the gods that pushes Greeks, I think, into a world. That's what impels their particular fascination in atheism.
My guest today is Professor Tim Whitmarsh. He's a professor of Greek culture at the University of Cambridge, currently a visiting professor at the University of Chicago, and the author of Battling the Gods, Atheism in the Ancient World. It's published by Knopf, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. When you're talking about Greek culture, you're talking about gods with all too human foibles, which I'm interested in how they use these myths as precautionary tales or like inspiration for good living in a way, but not in a particular, well, I guess there was worshipful way. You would leave sacrifices for gods. You would go to the various temples for, you know, good harvest or blessed marriage or whatever. But they used religion in a very, very different way, didn't they?
They did. Yes, that's right. So religion is generally perceived as, scholars of ancient religion make a distinction between orthodoxy and orthopraxy. And orthodoxy means that religion has to be done in terms of right belief, which is essentially a Christian idea or Judeo-Christian idea, more Christian really. And orthopraxy is an idea that religion is built around the right performance of rituals at the right times and in the right places. And that's much more the Greek sense of things. That's to say, it's built around the ritual of sacrifice. And when you perform a sacrificial ritual, it's very tied to a particular locale and has to be done at a certain time. And that's, it is a big distinction. But the Greeks also have a very strong sense of the interrelationship between gods and morality and the governing of the moral order. It's very strange that their earliest and their most canonical text is the works of Homer, and the Iliad and the Odyssey, as you say, present gods doing all sorts of things. The most notorious bit in the Odyssey is the bit where Ares and Aphrodite have an affair behind the back of the god Hephaestus, who's supposed to be married to Aphrodite. And Greeks always troubled with this. I mean, they ask themselves, what's going on with this apparently deeply immoral myth at the heart of one of their most canonical texts? So it's not as if the Greeks didn't worry about divine morality. They thought about that the whole time, and there were all sorts of strategies that they adopted to try to rewrite or reimagine the Homeric text to make them more moral. One of them was allegory, for example. So you can say that actually we're not really talking about gods in the conventional sense. We're talking about different combinations of elements in the universe and that sort of thing. They're sort of allegories for the physical material world and so forth. But yeah, I do think that that issue was never fully resolved for the Greeks, that how they related the desire for gods to be moral and, in a way, omnipotent even, how they reconciled that with the fact that their most canonical texts showed gods behaving in very unpredictable, very... But in a way, you know, I mean, I do think everything comes out in the wash, really. And in a way, that was one of the great advantages of Greek culture, was that they had these texts that they weren't closed moral systems. I'm not saying that the Bible or the Quran or anything is a closed moral system. But the fact that the Greeks debated endlessly what was going on in these texts, and that, as I say, that sort of canonical image of Godhead was so unproblematic and so difficult to work out. I think that's the beginning of philosophy. It's really, it's when people are impelled to question what other people have taken as the stable element of their society. And, you know, you just have to start rethinking. So I would say that questioning the nature of the gods, perhaps not atheism, but that sort of subversive interrogation of the nature of the divine started very early in Greek culture because their canonical text was so incoherent on the matter of the divine.
You refer to the Iliad as a canonical text. It was as close to a scripture as they had. They did not have scripture. So this was more than just an epic poem. It was a story of how the supernatural worked, the polytheistic world worked?
I would say yes and no to that. I mean, absolutely, the Iliad and the Odyssey. And there's another poet called Hesiod who has texts that are roughly in the same category as well. But these are the most important texts for Greeks, and everyone in the Greek-speaking world has awareness of the stories, and over time they get awareness of the, you know, deep learning or deep understanding of the texts themselves, to the extent that, you know, if you quote sort of Iliad, book 16, line 33 or whatever, then everyone would be able to recognize it. So in that sense, it's absolutely comparable to the kind of authority that the Bible and the Quran have for Jews, Christians, and Muslims. But what is different about it is that it's really a text about mortality and this central figure of Achilles, this endlessly alluring figure who has divine parentage. So in a sense, he's sort of he has a stake in immortality, and he has this choice to make between either a long life with no fame or a short life with the most glorious efflorescence of fame. And of course, he chooses the latter, but he chooses the latter because his best friend Patroclus is killed by Hector, the leading Trojan. So it's a very human story about personal attachment, leading an individual to sacrifice his own possibility for a long life, but going instead for this very short, condensed, glorious life, which gives him a form of immortality, that's to say the fame, the glory that comes with his death and sacrifice at that point. But it's not divine immortality, it's immortality at the human plane. So really, yes, the Iliad and the Odyssey are stories about what it is to be a human being. And they're also stories about the deep past of the Greek world as well, because the time of the Trojan War was seen as the, you know, the sort of the foundational moment for Greeks. And they were viewed as sort of historical epics in a sense. I mean, I think most people would have said, most Greeks would have said that they're very much embellished with all sorts of divine and supernatural apparatus, but they're essentially true. They see the Trojan War as their big, you know, national epic of the first time that the Greeks acted together in concert against a foreign foe.
Yeah, and that's also important too. It's almost like a foundational document for the state, if you will, because of the city-state system where you had at times bitter enmity between some of those city-states, and they were fractious. And so that sort of it becomes a sort of a pseudo religious sort of pseudo state document in a way.
It does, yes, and it's even more complicated than that at one level because, as you say, Greece is not politically centralized at all. There's no capital of Greece, and there's no you know, passport system or anything like that which is holding it all together. What you've got is simply 1,200 or so isolated communities, all of whom think of themselves as Greek, and they're held together by very fragile ties, and these fragile ties include the shared investment in the story of the Trojan War, and they also include shared worship of gods and language as well, obviously is another thing that holds things together. But there's, it's a very fractured, pluralistic model of society, which is very different to the kind of model that we've grown up with in the modern world, where we tend to think of a state as centralized and built around the capital and very tightly controlled. I mean, but this is a really recent development. It's last, you know, this is from the 18th century onwards, the age of nation building. So yeah.
Maybe that explains our current situation in the United States, where many are arguing for a decentralized state, where there is more power to the states. Maybe we should be looking to the Greeks for what's going on in our current society. I want to get back to another question you were referring to. You know, says because these documents are not scripture, and the motives and stories of the gods are so altogether human, there was endless arguing. And out of that becomes this group of philosophers that are basically saying, well, there is no God.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So there are several stages in this development of philosophy. As I say, I mean, it really comes out of a questioning of the Homeric and Hesiodic texts, the fact that these are not morally or theologically coherent texts impels the emergence of philosophy from the 6th century or so onwards. And the first phase of that emergence is the group that people tend to call the pre-Socratics, that's to say, before Socrates. And that's a very loose label, a very diverse group of people. But essentially what unites them is an interest in the physical world. And they move away from the idea of the anthropomorphic deity, the deity that is in the guise of a human being, and they move towards an idea of a deity which is more like a sort of universal nature. The deity becomes the way of explaining why, for example, the celestial bodies move in a regular order, why things grow in the way they do, why seasons occur. It's an explanation for the repetitive nature of the physical world around us. And this first stage in philosophy really paves the way for people who are materialists in the stronger sense of the word, which is something you begin to see in the 5th century BCE. Hippon of Samos, Samos is thought to be the first truly materialist philosopher, somebody who says that actually you don't need an idea of God at all. Matter itself is enough of an explanation for the way that the world works. Mm.
And that's amazing. It sounds like physicists today.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. And I say matter, actually. The materialist philosophers, Democritus is the most famous of these, and then Epicurus a little later. The materialist philosophers talk about the two essential components being not just matter, but void as well. So it's matter and the space between individual atoms. I mean, the word atoms, our word atoms, comes from the Greek materialists themselves, and it means something that is indivisible. So the smallest element of matter is an atom, and there is space in between it. And that is that space in between the atoms that gives the possibility for motion and gives the possibility for randomness as well, because the world isn't predictable. So it's just the play between the indivisible nature of the individual atom and the plurality of gaps that really, in the materialist conception of the world, creates the possibility for life, for dynamism, for repetition, but also for randomness as well.
We're just about out of time. My guest today is Tim Whitmarsh, a professor of Greek culture at the University of Cambridge and author of Battling the Gods, Atheism in the Ancient World. It's published by Knopf. And we spent time talking about the Greeks. What happens when Roman culture supplants Greek culture, although there was this sort of merging in many ways? Do you also see this signs of rejection of the official polytheistic religions? And then once Christianity is brought into Roman culture, rejection of that?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is that Roman culture and Greek culture are pretty much simultaneous. It's true that the Romans take over the Greek world from the 2nd century BC onwards. But Greek culture continues to be very powerful as a source of intellectual ideas. And it's really Roman atheistic ideas come out of dialogue with the Greek tradition. So I mentioned Lucretius, the poet Lucretius, who is a Roman poet writing in Latin, but very much working with the ideas of the Greek philosopher Epicurus. Another really interesting and important person is Cicero, who writes a treatise on the nature of the gods, which again explores the idea that, you know, there are different perspectives on the gods, including atheistic perspectives on the gods. But one thing I would say that makes a real difference with the interaction between Greek and Roman culture is that with Roman culture, when the Greek world interacts with the world of Rome, then the Roman culture is the beginning of its journey towards a centralized imperial state, and that's the real big shift. That's when you start getting the conditions emerging, the political conditions emerging for the possibility of monotheism as a state religion. I mean, of course, it has been in the Jewish Israelite world as well, but I mean, in the Greco-Roman world, as we mentioned earlier, the Greek world is just incredibly diverse politically. So you've got all these different states doing their different things, and they're held together by a belief that that system operates together. But you can't actually have a centralized monotheistic world in that kind of context. But when Rome comes along, and you've actually got Rome as the hub of a huge diverse empire, then you've got the political possibilities for the idea of a centralized religion based around the idea of not only one emperor, but one god. And that's what comes in the 4th century AD.
Yeah. We're out of time, unfortunately. It's a really interesting book, Battling the Gods, Atheism in the Ancient World. Tim Whitmarsh, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich. It's a real pleasure.
Professor Tim Whitmarsh is a professor of Greek culture at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. He's currently visiting professor of classics at the University of Chicago. His new book is titled Battling the Gods, Atheism in the Ancient World. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Just a reminder, tomorrow we'll be featuring some Thanksgiving Day specials, including Turkey Confidential with Lynn Rosetta Casper. And we'll be featuring the best of Studio Tulsa on Friday. We'll be back with a new episode next Monday. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for joining us.